Welcome, everyone. News of the money world. Here we are again. Rupert Carlin. Good morning. How are you? So
I'm very good. How are you this morning, Gussie?
Very good. Very good. Didn't know if you're going to respond, so I was just going to railroad right over the top of that and just start talking. So
yeah. Standard. We don't listen to each other. We just talk at each other.
Yeah, talk at each other. That's right. We're having great conversations according to ourselves. But yeah, hopefully today everybody else can listen in on us. There's a lot going on, a lot to get through. So we're going to just compress everything as much as we can today. The United States blitzes global counterparts globally. I put that sentence together this morning just for this session today. And that's put into question future interest rate trajectories and inflation pressures. Gold, silver, Bitcoin, and bond markets signal higher inflation and interest rates could be up ahead, similar to like 1970s. And here in New Zealand, the gap between job applications and actual jobs available suggests our economy might be in free fall of some sort. Geopolitical tensions take a step up, made complicated due to the upcoming U.S. election in a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, oil prices remain stable. What's the deal with that? And on the topic of energy, electricity is the new oil, apparently, with shifts to nuclear occurring in the tech sector. Bitcoin and Trump correlation and a surprising risk on sentiment hits the markets. That's my best summation of what we're going to be talking about today, Rupert. So let's start off with inflationary pressures and let's talk about what's happening in the U.S. and what comes here in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? I think we said a few weeks ago, inflation potentially been beaten, right? We've had a print of 2.2% here in New Zealand. The U.S. is still running hot. That's kind of in the threes, low threes. You've got Europe down in the twos. You've got China, which is kind of deflation, I think, is where they're heading. Japan coming right down. It's almost as though we're moving back to the traditional, typical economic fundamentals, right? We've got a world where the economy is going really, really well, they're running hot, inflation is running high, and the economies that are struggling are kind of coming out pretty low. And I think what's really interesting about that is it shows there's a huge amount of risk for the US that they actually have been pretty premature with that 50 basis point cut. And that we are about to see a real acceleration. Remember, we've still got jobless kind of an unemployment rate in the low fours, which is below the historical norms. We've still got pretty strong economic growth. And it's actually really interesting. But what's probably the kind of, I think, one of the best signs for economists and for people is that actually maybe we're referring back to a normal time. The kind of this fucked up world that we've been in over the last 5 years of post-COVID, supply chains, politics, stimulus, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know what? Maybe we're back to the old world of strong economy, low unemployment equals inflation, weak economy, unemployment rising means deflation. I don't know. It's a really interesting set of facts that we're starting to see.
What do you think about the U.S. election piece, though? So we're 2 weeks out, I think, from the U.S. election. And in the States, we've had 3 or 4 months now of falling unemployment rate. So I think we're at 4.1% right now. So that's a big tick. Markets are doing really, really well. And yeah, inflation is a little bit higher than needed, but it's going in the right direction. Interest rates are dropping. Isn't it just do you think that there might be a possibility that they're just trying to tick the boxes and try to engineer things? Give everybody a job at the government, for example, make sure everything looks good just leading up into the election, and then wait till after the election. Israel, Iran, they're blowing each other up. Hey, it's all good. We didn't get into power, but at least we can screw everything up for the next guy. Am I being a bit cynical here, Rupert? What do you think about that one?
I think it's really interesting, right? Because, yeah, it's a hard one. Remember we said at the start of the year it was going to be hard for the Fed to cut kind of post-July leading up into the election because they would be accused of having political interference. Instead, what they did is they went large in September, and in hindsight, that's potentially starting to look like a bit of a mistake. So only reinforcing that view of political interference. You've also got if I was a conspiracy theorist, you would also be in a world of saying, well, Donald Trump has been pretty clear around what he sees the role of the Fed, where he sees that he wants to have an influence on interest rate policy, what his views are of the Federal Reserve Chairman. So Look, I don't know, right? You've got, if the Fed are going to push one way, it's very clear that they're going to push to a world of decline of kind of Kamala Harris, because she is going to be the most normal. But look, I struggle to believe that they would go down that route because, I don't know, right? It is a really tough one, but I do suspect that if we lose, or sorry, if Trump loses,
that was a bit
there
of
will
a
be a lot there. Of kind of
go ahead, yeah,
massive Freudian slip. If Trump loses, look, I do firmly believe that there will be accusations that the US Fed helped engineer a Kamala Harris victory. Okay. I don't think they found it, but it is coming.
Yeah,
they've kind of walked right into this.
Yeah, that's right. I guess if we win, it could be all good anyway in the long term. But we'll see who we are, and we'll see what it is in the end. All right, let's talk about something less ambiguous and less likely to get us in trouble around politics. But here in New Zealand, again, still in the middle of like trying to assess the rate at which we are falling off a cliff, right? And then trying to anticipate what the response will be. Looking at mortgage rates, bank margins here in New Zealand, considering things like the 90-day bank bill rate and the official cash rate, it can kind of give you a hint as to what's going on behind the official numbers that we often anchor on, which is the official cash rate, which gets announced. We have another one late November. A lot of people will anchor on that and the significance of those actual dates. But behind the scenes, we're seeing bank margins increase. We're seeing wholesale rates fall. And it means something is coming, right? It means either that the market is effectively front-running what they think the official cash rate will be in the future, or it means that there's something coming where the Reserve Bank will be forced into dropping rates a lot faster. That's kind of what I'm trying to get out of this, or I'm trying to read in between the lines. Maybe I'm looking a little bit too closely, but what do these...
No, you are 100% right. I mean, so just to be clear, right, so how interest rates work. So you have effectively the OCR is effectively that's the overnight rate. So that's what banks can put money with the Reserve Bank, and then they'll receive that interest rate that they're paid on the OCR. So effectively from a bank, and if they're going to lend, then that means that they're going to need to earn a higher return than that. And if they're going to borrow money off others, then that's also kind of the benchmark of kind of what they see as the fair rate of borrowing as well. So OCR is today, right? So that's what I'm going to get when I go to the bank or the Reserve Bank and put some money in tonight. What though, to be fair, overnight borrowing is kind of useless for most people, right? Because if I'm a bank, I'm issuing 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 2 year, whatever. That's the mortgages that I'm issuing, right? Or I'm issuing loans with a fixed interest rate for that period of time. So what I need to do is I go on and borrow on my other side for a 2 year period. So if I'm issuing a 2 year mortgage to you, Darcy, I also need to borrow for 2 years to make sure that I've got an interest rate kind of they're matched. Otherwise, I'm at risk if one moves and I'm not hedged on the other side, which is what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank and a whole lot of others last year.
Yeah.
What that means, though, to price out a 2 year swap, which is effectively what the banks use, or one of the main avenues that the banks use to take their hedger to kind of do that. What they have to do is they have to forecast exactly what the OCR is going to be every day for that 2 year period to sit there and go, cool. So today the OCR is 4.75. I think it's going to go to 4.25 in November. But actually, because my swap that I'm taking out, or I'm going to be issuing or buying that swap, needs to be over the next 2 years, then I need to kind of understand that the whole way through. So you are 100% right. I wouldn't use the word front running, but that is effectively what they are doing. They are forecasting what they believe the OCR is and where that goes. What is actually really, really interesting about the swap rates as they currently sit, I'm just trying to pull this up on my screen. Actually, what's kind of really interesting is, so 1 year swaps have dropped a lot, 2 year swaps have dropped a lot, over the last kind of month or so, in particular, as we kind of, as people have gone from maybe a 25 point cut in September to 50 point cut in September. And now actually the conversation in November is moving 50 to 75 points. But I think what's really interesting is 3-year rates and 5-year rates haven't moved a huge amount. If anything, they're ticking up, which indicates that investors are kind of starting to get concerned on inflation at the moment. So what that means the market is saying is they're saying, yep, back to your kind of hypothesis, we do believe the markets, the economy is in free fall. We do believe there are some real short-term challenges with where the market sits right now. However, we think we're either going to get that through that pretty quickly and the inflationary pressures are going to pick up again, which is why on a 3-year basis, we're kind of the view that actually we kind of haven't really changed our view at that level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that, thank you for that explanation as well. That's really clear. And I think that when you hear concepts like yield curve inversion and the yield curve uninverting, it can sometimes feel a little bit far away and separated from, you know, real life. But when you look at mortgage rates just right now, you can see that we don't have an inverse yield curve when you look at the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 year fixed rate mortgages. We used to have a situation where the 1 and the 2 year especially were very high relative to the 3, 4, and 5 year fixed rates. But we've had a, and I believe the term is called a bull steepener. We've had the shorter term rates drop and the longer term rates, actually the 4 and 5 year rates with one of the main banks actually just went up a little bit with one of the main banks. So we now have a situation kind of like Henry Ford, you can have every color as long as it's black. You can have every interest rate you can imagine as long as it's 5.59%. And what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that typically, when the yield curve uninverts, that signals the arrival of a recession. When it's inverted, it warns that a recession is ahead. And when it's positive, we're potentially in recovery mode as the market anticipates higher interest rates to come to offset the inflation, which is a byproduct of lower interest rates. I might be butchering the explanation, but I guess that gives us a rough feel for the trajectory that at least market participants think will occur with interest rates. Did I capture that okay?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Just two technical terms that I think kind of important. So one is the yield curve. So when we talk about the yield curve, what that means, right, is so interest rates are generally issued on a, well, on a 0 day. So 0 day is OCR, a 90 day, 6 month, 12 month, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, and all the way through. And the curve is the indication of where the interest rate sits on the way through. And so the curve is typically going up. So up here, I've got my kind of my 5-year swap or my 10-year swap, because as an investor, I need to be rewarded for the extra duration that I've locked up that money. So because I've locked up that money for 10 years versus if I lock it up for 1 year, I shouldn't be there, right? So all things being equal, you should always have a positive kind of interest rate curve. What Darcy's talking about is an inverted curve where actually we've got a 1 year rate, which is higher than the 10 year rate. And that's what we've had for a little bit of time. And that's kind of a strong signal that we're heading for a recession because investors think that things are about to get worse. So 100% right, though very technical today.
That's good. Hey, got to be technical, got to be accurate. Is there any more? I think you said there was two
things. One of the things I find interesting about the yield curve, though, and where we're at, is actually because we can see the swap rates in the market and we can see where it's at, there's a really strong kind of implication here, right, which is actually banks are earning a lot more margin than they have in the past. So in the last couple of years, they've kind of their margins have been anywhere between 1 to 1.5%. So that's where the fixed rate mortgages are over the top of swap rates. Whereas today, they're kind of typically they're in and around that 2%, just over 2% as well, which is actually really interesting because it shows they're earning quite high margins. But if the market is right in what they believe in interest rates, there's a kind of a strong view that the only thing that's going to change that should change from here in terms of interest rates, the mortgage rates coming down further, is if banks are willing to cut margin, because actually the market's pricing in the 50 basis points come November, but they are anticipating that recovery starting early next year, which is kind of interesting. So hopefully the Commerce Commission will be able to get us cheaper mortgage rates, but I fear that they're going to be the only ones. What that does imply is 5.5% mortgage rates, which is kind of where we're sitting, and interesting your point around that's where they're sitting across the curve. That's a really interesting point, because actually I suspect I'd be surprised if they go much lower, right? We all need to remember we are not going back to the world that we were in 3 years ago. Maybe we get back to the pre-COVID world, but I think we have to look at and be kind of conscious that interest rates are probably going to stay in that 5-6% range moving forward.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting call. And just like a little bit tangential to this, thinking about the natural sort of righteous anger that one would have with the banks, knowing that they're keeping their margins relatively high while their costs are falling, i.e., hey, we could have a lot cheaper mortgage rates if they pass those lower costs on to us. That makes one feel a little bit angry, justifiably, because we're struggling and these banks are getting more profitable on the way out. But one of the things that we need to remember is that the Reserve Bank themselves, or any central bank, will do this. They will increase interest rates anyway. And it's not about necessarily making money off of you. It's about taking the money away from you that you would otherwise spend in the economy, which could then exacerbate the inflation problem. And so whether it's a bank taking supernormal profits or it's a Reserve Bank cranking up the OCR and leaving it there for too long, it has the same effect. It's money that we can't spend. So are we justified being angry at banks taking these profits when in reality the Reserve Bank is going to compensate for that anyway?
We should be, to be blunt, because at the end of the day, what they are, rather than passing that through, so we could be having these impacts faster if we were there, but instead the banks are using this kind of this reduction in interest rates to take a little bit of margin on the way through. A little bit like oil companies and petrol prices, right? Mm-hmm. They'll raise their rates immediately the moment that oil prices kind of rise, but it takes a long time for them to drop as they kind of keep on coming down as well. So look, I do think we should be, I don't think it's right. You are probably right that the Reserve Bank takes this into account when they're setting their policies and setting their rates. But fundamentally, I don't think it is right when you've got the banks earning record profits and they're kind of sitting there earning the highest return on equity in the developed world, right? Some of the highest returns on equity in the world. That is just a tax on New Zealanders. And if I'm going to pay a tax, I'd probably rather pay it to the government than pay it to an Australian-owned bank.
Sure. Yeah. No, fair enough. I understand that. Okay. Well, that's good. Fair enough. Hey, geopolitical stuff. So this year, one of the things that's caught me off guard, well, several things actually, but the two big things would be, and we'll talk about this later on, the correlation between support for Donald Trump and the price of Bitcoin. Didn't have that on my bingo card. Yep. But also the positive investor sentiment during a period of time of insane geopolitical tension. This has really blown me away. And if those that are watching or listening are vaguely aware of what's happening in the Middle East or what has been happening in the Middle East, there was a barrage of missiles and rockets launched at Israel, like quite, you know, Armageddon-like, what we saw not that long ago, only at 2 or 3 weeks ago, I guess. And recently, Israel is now reviewing their response. They're double-checking their Iranian target list in light of a recent drone attack that targeted the prime minister's holiday home in Caesarea. Thankfully, wasn't in there. But we're 2 weeks away from a U.S. election again. And the longer that we're waiting for a response out of Israel on Iran, I'm thinking, hey, maybe it's more reasonable to assume it's going to be quite a big response. And so I then look at things like the price of oil, around about that $70-ish per barrel, and asking some questions. What does this say about the world that we're living in? What can we learn from the price of oil in light of these tensions occurring in the Middle East?
So I think there's two parts, right? So I'll answer the first question, and then I've got a view on I've answered the second question, then I've got a view on the politics, and the second question is the first part of it as well. So oil is a really good gauge for how hot the global economy is, right? Because the more oil, the more that the world is going nuts, so means that the more oil has been consumed, right? So whether it be, it still powers a lot of power plants around the world, people kind of transport, whether that be planes, trains, or cars, trucks, et cetera, right? So, and also, to be fair, oil makes up about 5% of the input costs of most goods that are transported, that most goods full stop, right? Because if you think about plastic and a lot of the synthetic stuff that we use, it all comes from oil as well. So typically what you find is a very strong economy means oil prices kind of are very high, and a pretty weak economy means that we end up in falling oil prices as well. What's really interesting at the moment, right, you talk about the Middle East, where we've got a massive kind of the potential issues around that. If there is kind of a full-on broader conflict there between Iran and Israel, there's a strong chance that Israel's 3 million barrels a day will be shut. I mean, sorry, Iran's 3 million barrels a day will be shut down, but which isn't the end of the world in itself. There's probably the bigger issue is that Iran could block the Strait of Hormuz, which is a tiny piece of water, which is actually where most of the Saudi and most of the oil coming out of the Middle East goes. And so that's the big thing that people worry about, is actually what happens to the transport of the other oil as well. So I actually find it really interesting right now when we're kind of sitting in a world of going massive tension on where we're at. You've also got the Houthis who continue to attack a lot of these oil tankers as well. So we've got massive tensions. And at the same time, oil kind of continues to fall, which I think is a really good indication of two things. One is the economy is clearly weaker than we expect. And we've seen those prints recently, right? We've seen the prints out of Europe, which is starting. Germany is clearly in recession and looking pretty sick. And when Germany's sick, fuck, be worried for the rest of Europe. That's going to be pretty worrying to watch. We've got China, which is deflation recession mode. We've got Japan, which is verging on kind of recession again. It's really kind of where we're getting to. And the second part of it, which is actually really interesting, is the fracking boom in the US. And now with the US being a net energy exporter, they don't really care, right? Because what they can do is they can actually, they're producing more than they can use. They're refining their own product now. There are different types of crude and different grades of crude, so they still import a bit. But actually, I think this oil world is becoming very, very different. It does beg the massive, massive question of how hard does the US want to fight to protect the Middle East, given they don't have, no longer have a reliance on oil as well. But I think for me, the key takeaway on kind of the $70 oil price is it demonstrates a really weak global economy and probably weaker than we think. Our global numbers are being kind of supported by the strong US consumer as they have for a long time. Mm. On the first point around Iran, and Israel, and why is Israel delaying? I suspect the big reason is everyone is waiting for the 5th of November. There's a little election happening in a place called the US of A on the 5th of November. And I think if Trump gets in, there's pretty clear signs that Trump's going to do whatever he can to support Israel, and he's just going to let them go for it. There will be no holds barred, and I suspect that's what they're waiting for, is to understand and get better clarity around the outcome of the election, because at the same time, if they go hard now and Kamala gets in, that could cause them a few issues down the track.
Mm. There's lots in that, right? And it's symptomatic, though. Like, both of those threads that you were pulling on there are symptomatic of a deglobalizing world, right? Like, we're not as dependent on Middle East oil. Therefore, there's realignment. There's new connections being formed, like, I guess, the synapses in the brain, right? Just reconnecting, finding different pathways so that global commerce can continue. Trading partner ratios will change from one country to another. New suppliers will be located. There'll be new trade agreements being built during this time. It's a fascinating thing. And this East and West, I use those terms very loosely, of course, this battle between East and West is very real. It's very obvious. And the main arena is the middle of the world, which is from basically from Europe to Iran, effectively, right? That middle part, that's the battleground. That's where it's all happening. And yeah, you're right. Like, if there's nothing to fight for, why would the U.S. want to fight for it? But then the other thing is also quite fascinating in terms of how it relates to global stability, because the world is a very complicated place with a lot of factors going on here, and it works. It's all held in balance, quite fragile, but it kind of works. It's organized chaos. And in the Middle East in particular, you have to be, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but it seems like you have to be the biggest bully for people to believe you so that they stay in their space. And if there is a very strong response, then stability occurs. But when there is this weak-handed approach to things, that's when we get this prolonged conflict that occurs. It's not right or wrong. It is just the way it works in that part of the neighborhood. And so, yeah, that's why I think it is fascinating these next 2 weeks. You're right. I think a lot of people are watching and trying to interpret what this means and what they can get away with before and after.
Yeah.
And we are watching a very incredible time in history right now. I'm convinced that this is going to be a very historical next 2 or 3 weeks, and even up until January, right? So I guess when we kind of think about other things going on, and this is loosely connected to oil, electricity seems to be the new oil. And when we look at things like Bitcoin mining, one of the greatest bits of negative media, which was, I guess you could question where that came from, was that Bitcoin was bad for the environment because of the mining. And yeah, it's incredibly energy intensive. It's actually great for the environment when you talk about renewable energy, but that's another discussion. We're seeing tech companies now have the same problem, not with the same negative media attention, funnily enough, but tech companies, Google, Microsoft, they need to feed their AI beast, which is growing. And they're now looking at nuclear power. So like, that's insane, right? Like, you're actually creating nuclear, or you're bringing more nuclear power online just so that you can use ChatGPT more effectively. Of course, that's not true. I'm exaggerating, but yeah.
Not fucking true.
Where does it go though? Are we going to see that we're going to have nuclear powers all over the show just to run our computers? Is that where this goes?
Well, I think it's a fascinating conversation, right? And it's really interesting to say, so we've had our power issues here in New Zealand over the last kind of 6 months and are likely to keep on going because we don't have any investment at all going to electricity. But it's, yeah, I kind of read some of this. So in Google has just commissioned, I think it's 4 of the new kind of small scale nuclear reactors to be built to power its Google Cloud. And then of course, Microsoft has looked to recommission, I think it was one of the big nuclear facilities in California that has recently been decommissioned, which shows two things. It shows the humongous energy requirements for these companies and for what they need to do. The other thing that it does is it shows actually we are moving into a world, a massive energy shortage as we move into a world of EVs plus computing, which is kind of going to, I think that's going to be really interesting. But it also shows this old world of technology that we've lived in for a very long time, where you built a product, you just flew it out the door, and there was almost zero marginal cost attached to that user. Those days are over, right? Because if you kind of 5 years ago, everyone would have laughed at you if they'd said to you, I need to kind of build a nuclear power plant just to deliver my computing power. But that's the world that we come in, and we know that's not cheap. We know that's very, very expensive. I mean, what Google have just commissioned is probably the equivalent of New Zealand's entire power supply. And so that's kind of where it's actually really interesting, kind of when you look at what's happening in this world. All of a sudden makes Bitcoin look a whole lot less ugly though, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, well, it does. And it also makes Bitcoin look really useful too, because especially places like New Zealand where, hey, nuclear isn't an option. How can we actually incentivize renewable energy production? Well, we can get Bitcoin mining and we can get AI mining effectively happening at scale in New Zealand near where there could be renewable energy development. And then you create the demand for it until the infrastructure is built out to bring that to you and I as consumers. So yeah, like I guess as we finish onto the Bitcoin piece, we're seeing Bitcoin hover around all-time highs still. And I should point out as well, gold, silver especially, massive run-up recently. And depending on what happens from here, it could actually really go quite well. Not financial advice, of course, but interesting to see these monetary-like assets really take off. And I was probably about, what, four or five years early in this one. But it's really cool to see that because it's playing into a thesis that was evident for a while, but COVID accelerated everything. And with this year, again, I mentioned already that the correlation between Trump potentially getting in and the price of Bitcoin seems to be quite high. Wouldn't have predicted that. But what do you see happening here? Like this is kind of like the season. We are expecting that probably in the next 6 months, we're going to see new all-time highs in the Bitcoin community. That is what their thinking is. And it's been a weird year with the ETFs kind of causing that premature run-up in price early on this year. So what do you see heading into the tail end of this calendar year and for early part of next year with Bitcoin?
I think I see two things. I see we're in a massive risk on sentiment environment at the moment, right? And that's why we see stock prices hitting all-time highs every single day. And look, we do know Bitcoin does extremely well in those risk on sentiments. And as long as we keep into that world, which as we've kind of talked about with what's happening in the US, there's no real reason to see that ending anytime soon. And then the flip side, on the other side of it, where we've also got a world of Donald Trump. Donald Trump has made it very, very clear that he will be very supportive of the US crypto industry. He's made it very clear that Gary Gensler goes the day he gets appointed. He's made it clear that he will kind of change and amend the rules and regulations to make it easier. He's already tried to launch a token a couple of weeks ago. That didn't work quite as well as he had initially hoped. So look, he's very good at following the money and he's figured out that he can make a whole lot of money by jumping on this one. And so he's going to try pretty hard. So I think we've got risk on, we've got the Donald Trump factor. The big question is if he doesn't get in, is that become a massive negative? And actually I do believe it probably does become a bit of a negative in the short term. But again, Kamala Harris has also talked about being positive in this world too. The third piece actually though, is institutions. So there's a recent survey last week by, I think it might've been BlackRock or one of the big guys. He's talking about something like 35 to 40% of hedge funds have now dabbled in crypto. And that's what those ETFs are doing. These ETFs are making life really easy for those people to participate. You've got BlackRock, so Larry Fink, the most hated man amongst the conspiracy theorists who love Bitcoin, who's basically come out a couple of weeks ago saying, hold on a sec, it's an asset that should be as large as the US housing market as an asset class. So he's sitting there going, it's $1.5 trillion today. It should be $50 trillion at some point in the future. That seems a bit brave. He's got his main research guys coming out talking about how important it is to put it in your portfolios and the long-term view. So I think we do have some of those two first things, which are the short-term sentiment. But I think we are also starting to see that long-term kind of shift change in beliefs and in views happen. And in my mind, that's kind of what sets it up for a really good run into that kind of medium term, right?
Yeah.
Whether that's between now and Christmas, I don't know. But yeah, if anything, from what we're seeing out of BlackRock, what we're seeing in terms of the institutional ownership, we got every reason to believe that it's only going to get stronger and stronger.
Yeah, it's really hard, eh? Like watching this space I've been watching this space for about 7 years in Bitcoin, and it is really hard not to get extremely excited about the long-term potential reality, and then to become anchored on those assumptions so much so that you look at every single political event or financial event or speaking engagement as the lining up of the sequences that must occur before Bitcoin really is like $1 trillion a coin, right? So it's really hard not to get carried away. Like, there is no moderate version when it comes to speculating around Bitcoin. It either does go to zero or it does go to infinity. And it's kind of hard to imagine a world where it kind of just slowly fades away into irrelevance. It's probably going to quickly crash and burn and become worthless rat poison, or it will become the base layer of the next financial global system. Who knows? And I look forward to watching it, though. Like, it's a great show, as long as you have a reasonable amount of exposure. Again, not financial advice, but that's good. Okay, I think we've covered everything, haven't we, Rupert? Like, there's probably a lot.
We've covered a lot.
Yeah. I think, like, with the election piece in particular, there's probably a lot more that we could go into around that and just how that is influencing markets. And so I'm going to be watching that probably a little bit more with interest, as will the entire world over the next 2 weeks. That and what's happening in the Middle East are the two big things that I've been watching lately. So good times, man. Good chat, though.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And well, let's see. I mean, I suspect we'll be in a very different world by next week.
Crazy. Yeah, I agree. Have a good one, Rupert.